We have Claire on the line, and Claire was just telling us the amazing story of her mother who had cancer, and for 9 years she was receiving Alectinib from Dr. Krebs, who was the man who actually discovered the essential element here. It was a vitamin B17. And, of course, I remember when I was in medical school studying biochemistry, and we studied the Krebs cycle. And so the name Kreb is very well known to me, and apparently this was the son of the original Dr. Krebs, and then apparently there was another Dr. Krebs down the line. Claire, what year was that when your mother...
She died in 72.
All right, fine.
So this was probably in 70.
Okay.
That then everything hit the fan.
All right, and of course...
She deteriorated so badly and so rapidly when she couldn't get it that the pain became intense, and my father took her to a doctor who for pain pills, and he refused to treat her unless she agreed to sign over a willingness to be treated with x-ray and chemotherapy, which was totally against her because my folks had been, I mean, she was one who used carrot juice and, you know, did everything she could to eat well, naturally. And so that was her signing her death warrant. She lived, she went through 2 years of hell, and she died of the x-ray and chemotherapy.
Sure. Well, of course,
it was just tragic. Besides, they divested her of over $100,000 for this less than 2 years of treatment and dying horribly. And I just am so concerned, because that's just one of numerous stories I could tell. Now, by the way, we took her to Hoxie Clinic, because in Mexico, and they gave her, shortly before she died, and they gave her things. But apparently we went too late, and it was not able to help her. And so it would have been better that she had not lived those 2 years.
Well, the one thing I was always impressed with, you know, from the stories that I heard, I remember what Dr. Dean Burke told me, and from a few other doctors who I know who had had the courage to treat a few patients with this, was that patients ordinarily felt a lot better. They put on weight, it relieved their pain. Now, it didn't always cure everybody if they were too far into their cancer, and I don't think it ever cured anybody, but it suppressed the cancer. And well, what was your take on that, Ed? Because you know a lot more about it than I do.
The word cure, yeah, let's talk about that. There's a different meaning of the word cure in some people's minds. Technically, I think a professional has got to say that there is no cure for cancer, that once you have it, you always have it, and that the best you can hope for is to control it. However, from a patient's point of view, if they have cancer and they're sick and they feel like they're going to die and they can't get out of bed, and you start giving them Laetril or whatever else, and a few months later then they're out playing golf again, they're, in their mind, they're cured. Now, it's true that it could come back if they get off of the treatment and so forth, that the condition remains underneath, but the average person would say that they're cured if they're not feeling sick and can perform their life functions in the same way that they always did.
And so basically, it would be something that you would continue taking more or less indefinitely?
Yes, that has been my observation over the years. I'd like to use the analogy of a balloon. If a balloon becomes weakened in one spot and sort of a little bulge comes out of the side of it, you can take your hand and push that bulge back. Okay, but the minute you take your hand away, the bulge will pop back out again. And it seems to me that from what I've seen, once a person has developed clinical cancer, that you can get it back under control okay with nutrition, Laetril, and lifestyle, but you better not walk away from it and pretend like you were the same as you always were, because you have to maintain your program in order to keep that bulge from coming back again.
So would you have to take an Laetril shot every 3 months?
Oh, no, I've never seen that. Most people who go on Laetril have their shot therapy only during the first 4, 5, or 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just to get massive doses into them. After that, they taper off to just a tablet a day or every other day or something like that.
Now, can you get the tablets in the United States today?
You can get them. Uh-huh. They're available, of course, in the black market. It's
okay.
Too bad that that's the case, but that's because of the legal sanctions. But there are some doctors that will go through the rigmarole and prescribe it, and you have to get an affidavit, and it's a lot of work to get it. but you can if you're absolutely determined to do it.
Now, can you get the intravenous shots? Does any doctor dare give those shots today?
Yes, but you have to go through that affidavit system that I mentioned. The Supreme Court determined some years ago that if a doctor will prescribe this particular substance, and if they tell the patient that that the FDA does not approve of it, and if the patient then secures the material on his own or her own from a source outside of the United States and it gets shipped in, you know, all of this paperwork has to be done, then the doctor or a nurse can inject it into them. And there are a few doctors that do that.
But doesn't that doctor endanger his medical license in that state?
Absolutely.
Okay,
very
fine.
Courageous men.
Claire, any other thoughts or comments?
I think your doctor was absolutely correct. It's a deficiency. And I think this would explain why one has to continue taking it once it has proven effective in controlling it, because the deficiency that they had has been compensated for by taking the nitrilicide that was necessary. Mm-hmm. And so so it's correct, I think, in calling it a control, because we're talking about a condition of deprivation.
Now, it's interesting,
exactly.
You know, ordinarily as a physician, we would always talk about a five-year cure. If you had a five-year cure on cancer, that was felt to be that was sort of the ultimate. If you had a five-year cure on lung cancer, you had a five-year cure. And that just means that you lived for 5 years. That was the judgment. And it would sound as if your mother, the fact that she went 9 years, on Laetrile, and she might have gone a lot longer if you'd been able to continue having it.
I didn't have a clue there was anything wrong with her, and she had a very stressful life.
What sort of cancer did she have, do you recall?
She had lung cancer and breast cancer.
Lung cancer, so it's probably metastasized from her lung to her chest, do you think?
Yes, it started with the breast first.
I thought that one of the points that Ed brought out in his book was that, so many of the treatments we use today, the chemotherapeutic agents so suppress the immune system that you have one cancer that does better and then you develop other cancers. What's the background of that, Ed?
Well, you mean the metastasis?
Perhaps I may be mistaken, but I sort of, because I do so much reading, but sometimes I thought that in your book you said that if you took the chemotherapeutic agents, it so suppressed your immune system that you became susceptible to developing a different type of cancer.
I didn't understand what you were saying.
Right.
Absolutely. The chemotherapy and radiation both are terribly destructive of the immune system. And, of course, the immune system is one of the frontline defenses against cancer. So there's the illogic of using the orthodox therapy of chemotherapy and radiation as the treatment of cancer. One of the best ways you can think of to give a person cancer is to expose them to radiation. And if you give them poisonous drugs which will suppress their immune system, they will get cancer. So in both cases, the treatments of choice here, chemotherapy and radiation, create cancer. They cause cancer. They don't cure it.
Can I mention something?
Sure you can, Claire.
There's a book called Options, the Alternative Cancer Cures, and it has about 27 or 28 chapters, each one on a different alternative cancer method, and one chapter on the history of X-ray and radiation. This was written by a medical researcher whose mother died of cancer and was treated in the orthodox fashion, and in his anger, he researched these other forms, and this is where I first learned of Dr. Brzezinski. But he said in his example that in terms of the toxicity of X-ray and radiation, that or chemo, that if a woman had cancer of the uterus and had X-ray radiation and chemo, 18 years later she would have cancer of the lymph glands. And when I read that, I was stunned, because I had a friend in another town who 18 years before had cancer of the ovaries, and she now had and was being cured worked on all this time with X-ray and chemo, and now she had, lo and behold, cancer of the lymph glands.
Mm-hmm.
And when I I Xeroxed most of the book and mailed it to her, and I never heard from her again, and I heard through a mutual friend, how dare I try and break her trust in her doctor.
Sure.
Yes, well that's a common reaction for people, because they're frightened, and they just want to believe in their doctor.
But the doctor's doing the best. The trouble is, he's never heard any of this.
That's right.
And that is the great tragedy. And the last thing we want to do is break faith in doctors, but we have to be objective too, because we're dealing with life-threatening situations, and the tragedy is maybe we've got to start educating our doctors. And of course, with Ed's permission, I hope we can circulate this tape and get this out and other information to get people to start to think about what we're really talking about.
What is the doctor's book's name?
Now, this is not a doctor. This is a friend of mine of 35 years duration. His name is G. Edward Griffin. The book is World Without Cancer.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, you can get it by calling 1-800-282-2873. That's 1-800-282-2873. It's just been republished again. Is this the second edition, third edition?
Well, this is the second edition, but it's the, what printing? I have to look it up here. It's the 12th or 13th printing. I'm very proud of that because it just keeps people want it. So it's the 12th printing. So, but on this business of being a doctor, no, I'm not a doctor. In fact, I'm kind of grateful for that in a way. Because I started with a clean slate. I didn't have to unlearn anything.
I don't know if you know who Ed Griffin is, but he wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Yes, I have his book.
He wrote The Fearful Master, a couple of my favorite books. And what else have you written, Ed?
Oh, well, let's see. A lot of TV documentaries, probably. Those are the ones you might remember. The Grand Design, More Deadly Than War, Anarchy USA.
That was great. That was one of the great scripts of all time. Okay, well, we've still got a lot of those in our files here, but Ed is a very reliable individual, Claire. He would not put this out if he hadn't thoroughly documented it. And, of course, you can check the documentation on so much of what he has, but as far as Dr. Dean Burke, and he refers to him extensively, I have the advantage of having talked to him many years ago and been fascinated to find out who this man really was and what he was trying to get out, and, of course, the total blackout by the controlled media in America that certainly goes along with what, in my estimation, is a genocidal agenda. Anything else, Claire?
I'll let Mr. Griffin talk. I really value what you have to offer, and I could go on and on, but I can be here all the time.
Okay, fine.
So thank you for being here, Mr. Griffin.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And I have a comment on Dr. Burke that you might find interesting. When I did this second edition for the book and dug out all of my papers, you know, this goes way, way back, some of this original research, and it was almost like a new learning experience all over again for me. But I came across all of these photocopies of letters from Dr. Burke and Dr. Krebs and some of the early pioneers in this. And I realized that I had probably the only remaining copies of some of these important letters. And Dr. Burke in particular was just, he just came out with, you know, both barrels blasting away at the medical establishment. And even though I had quoted from some of these letters and papers in my book, in my footnote, I just said private papers, you know, in the author's file. And I decided that that probably wouldn't be good enough. If anybody really wanted to be skeptical about whether these men were really had really said what they did. So I decided to publish an auxiliary little book called Private Papers Relating to Laetrile. And I just took all of these fascinating letters from these pioneers, and I photographically reproduced them. And so for anybody that wants to get the whole story from the horse's mouth, so to speak, they can read it in their original papers in that little book.
And what's the title of it again?
It's called Private Papers Relating to Laetrile.
Okay, fine. And that's available, but the same number? That's
1-800? Yeah, that's available. Actually, we don't have but a couple of copies. I think I printed 20 copies. Thinking, well, you know, I'll send one to the Library of Congress and, you know, for anybody to research it. But lo and behold, people are ordering it now, and we have to go back and print 50 at a time.
Okay, fine. Well,
it's really only for the serious researcher,
sure.
Of course.
The whole story is just so, so incredible. In fact, I shall have to admit that I refuse to admit this to myself. I refuse to believe it. For many, many years, and I put Laetrile on the back shelf, and I knew a fellow had taken Laetrile, he got skin cancer. Well, skin cancer really comes from exposure to sun, and it's really a lot different than most other cancers, and, you know, you just snip them out, and that's the end of it, and he said, gee, my Laetrile didn't keep me from getting a skin cancer, but that's a whole different entity than most of these other cancers that we're talking about, and it wasn't until I really began talking to Dr. Brzezinski and to Dr. Day, and then remembering the video that you actually circulate the video on the Hoxie treatment and what happened to Hoxie.
Yes.
One of the most fascinating stories, because of this is a video. I don't think Ed actually made it, but somebody else made it, and it's made up of all the film clips of what happened when Hoxie had a cancer treatment, and he was going to, the AMA wanted to buy it up, and he said, I'll sell it to you, but correct me if I'm wrong on this story here, Ed, but if you have people who don't have any money, you got to give it to them for nothing, because that was the way that my father gave me the formula for this. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty close to it. Actually, it wasn't the AMA, but it was this guy in charge.
Morris Fishbein.
Morris Fishbein,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. From the AMA.
I didn't say it was the whole organization, but it was the number one man that wanted to buy it up and make a profit from it. Yes.
Right. And when, of course, he wouldn't sell it, then they set out to destroy him.
Yeah.
And he ended up suing, did he sue Fishbein or the AMA?
I believe it was a joint suit.
Okay, fine. And he actually won. You know, it's an amazing story, and you'll see all these film clips
Fishbein
in there.
Yeah, Fishbein lost his job over that one.
Right, and he well should have.
Yeah.
But, you know, anybody who wants to suppress a cancer treatment, I don't know what you call those people. I would call them either Nazis or murderers. But we got Dudley on the line here. Hi, Dudley.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Now, what do you think of this?
It's really fascinating.
And let me tell you, I've known Ed Griffin personally for 35 years. He's no fly-by-night writer. He's not the sensationalist. He's not, you know, out here simply to grind out new books so that he can make a lot of money. When he does something, he believes in it.
Well, I already have his first, or one of the books, The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Right, okay.
So I'll have to get this one.
So you know who we're talking about then.
Yeah. The question I have is that when I was over, you know, at the ACH seminar, I was given a bunch of the apricot pits. And I'm just curious, when I crack them and get the seed, are the seeds good for, what are they good for besides, I was going to say a simple thing like cancer, but is it worthwhile eating them? And you have to eat an awful lot of them to help?
The seeds are very nutritious. I remember at one time looking at the composition of the seeds. Unfortunately, I still don't have that in my file, but it was an amazing array of minerals and vitamins. At one time, I remember I was talking with Dr. Krebs Jr. about this, and it was his opinion that if a person would eat an apricot, the flesh and the seed, they'd have everything they would ever need in the way of nutrition and live healthy life. But primarily, I think our interest in the seed is because of its amygdalin content. Amygdalin. Well, that's Laetrile. That's what people call it. Its proper name is called amygdalin.
How do you spell that?
AMYGDALYN.
Oh, okay. Well, then, say if you take two or three seeds a day, would that be according to what your friend was saying, if you take one apricot a day, that would be pretty good. So if you just take the seed, a couple of seeds would be enough, probably.
Yes, we feel that if you took two or three seeds a day, it probably would be good prevention. Now, if you were sick and you really had a serious condition, you'd need more than that. But then I think you ought to see a physician and get some technical advice. But around our family, we just eat the equivalent of about three or four seeds a day, and we don't do it every day, but it's just sort of an average.
Well, it didn't seem, when I've eaten just a few of them a couple of weeks ago, and they didn't seem terribly bitter. They didn't seem, you know.
No, apparently if they're too bitter, why you don't want to eat them? They've got too high a dose of cyanide in them. So, actually, they're supposed to taste not bad at all.
Well, actually, as Stan, the bitter flavor is what you're after.
Well, but how bitter do you want it?
Because
in your book you said that over there in the area around Nepal in this valley, they would actually check the seeds, and if the seeds were too bitter, they'd cut down the tree. Wasn't that what you said?
Yeah, I've heard that.
I've heard that in your book.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know I had that in my book. But I have heard that, if it's too bitter, yes.
Right.
But that's probably because of taste. But if it's not a bitter flavor, you're not getting what you want. Actually, to test this, I think the best thing to do would be to get an apple and get about 6 or 7 apple seeds and chew them all up. And now if it's a fresh apple, you will get the same taste. And that is the taste you're looking for. Apple seeds, by the way, are a very good source of amygdalin.
And well, now, they are.
Now, yes. What about use of the oil? Didn't they cook in the oil that actually came from the apricot seed?
Yes, they use the oil for cooking and for grooming. But to my knowledge, there is no amygdalin in the oil.
Okay.
The other question was, you know, when you're talking about Hunza and these people didn't have cancer, of course, that would be right up, I shouldn't say the doctor's name, but when he talks about the glacial ice, you know, and the 70 trace minerals you get in the water and everything.
You're talking about Dr. Joel Wallach?
Yeah.
Right, well...
I'm talking about the fact that in Hunza, where apparently there's no... they didn't get where the people used to not have cancer because they were just eating apricots and things there. Maybe the water and everything was helping them.
Well, I think that's a good observation. I think that their whole lifestyle of the Hunza cuts indicated a healthy lifestyle. Not only were they eating raw fruits and vegetables, they ate relatively little meat. They vigorously exercised every day because they had to work. They tilled the fields, and their fields were up and down the sides of these mountains. They were climbing up and down every day. And they drank very mineral-rich water. However, I think that the minerals in the water, the so-called glacier milk, as they call it, mm-hmm. may have been more beneficial to humans because it was the water that was used on the plants. Mm-hmm. They irrigated their plants with that water, and so the soil was very, very rich in mineral, and the plants did an uptake on the minerals, and I think that was the main route of mineral intake, mm-hmm. rather than from drinking the water.
Other quick question was, like the Dr. Brzezinski in Texas, does he use Laetril or use something else?
He uses something else.
He uses an anti-neoplastin, which is a protein substance, which was originally, I think, identified in urine, and then he manufactures this, and apparently it can turn off cancer. The Laetril actually works by releasing the cyanide and killing the cancer cells. But the other, Dr. Brzezinski's treatment works entirely differently.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, fine. Let's go to Kevin here on the line. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Dr. Stan.
How you doing?
Hello, Ed Griffin. It's sure good to hear your voice again.
Thank you.
I want to tell you a little story before I ask the question that a few years ago, and I won't say how many and embarrass any of us, I was on my way to see your video, or it might have been a 16-millimeter movie, about the Laetril, World Without Cancer. And Bass Gladio came down to town to show it. Before I left home, I got a call from one of the local activists here. They asked me to swing by and pick up a gentleman that wanted to go, but he didn't have transportation. He didn't drive. He was pretty far on in the years. And so I went over and picked him up. And this guy was some sort of a medical researcher from the Seattle, Washington area. And his story was that he got to looking at sea creatures, fish, or anything else that lives in the sea, and he realized that those animals don't get cancer. And so he went to study to find out why. And his theory was that it has to do with the trace minerals in the seawater. So he went to the American Cancer Society to see if he can get some kind of a grant to get some money to really launch a study on this. And doggone it, the American Cancer Society says, no, they wouldn't give him the time of day. We can't help you. Your approach is too simplistic. And that was their answer. And I've heard that before in other cases. Your method of fighting cancer has too simplistic an approach. Have you ever heard that before?
Oh, yes, that's what they always say. In other words, what they're really trying to communicate is that the answer to cancer, as far as they're concerned, must be found in a complex drug, which can be patented.
Something they can sell.
Something they can patent and sell, yes.
Okay.
Not just sell, but patent, have a proprietary right on it, and that, of course, means that it can't be simple. It's got to be complex.
Okay. Right,
if it's simplistic like minerals in seawater, how can you patent that? You can't make a buck on that.
Right.
So that's the answer.
You know, they used to have, here in Santa Cruz, there used to be a seawater swimming pool down at the boardwalk. Mm-hmm. And the people, years ago, back in the 20s, I guess, people used to use it. It was called the plunge. And you know, a lot of people come from all over, and they'd get into that water, and they'd feel good.
Mm-hmm.
It just help their general complexion and attitude and everything else. Now, what about some of these people that used to, you mentioned some of the doctors that used to use the Laetrile. How about Dr. Richardson? Is he, do you have an update on where he is and what he's doing?
Well, Dr. Richardson passed away some years ago.
Okay.
He had a heart problem, and he didn't make it through.
Okay, and then the other question, down in Mexico, people used to go to the Contreras Clinic and also the Seidel Clinic. Is there any kind of an update on where would one go nowadays?
Well, I'm not familiar with all the clinics down there, but I do know that the Contreras Clinic is still there and quite modernized. I visited it about 4 or 5 weeks ago, and it's now called the Oasis of Hope.
Oasis of Hope.
Yes.
Well, now, how expensive is it to go and have Laetrile treatments? Because, of course, one of the big criticisms of the establishment was, well, you just put all this money out and it doesn't do you any good.
Well, I don't know the expense on the various clinics, but I can tell you that it's probably 1/50th or 1/100th of what it costs to die with chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery.
Now,
and besides that, it is effective in many cases.
I know, but what is, you know, if you get your far advanced cancer, what's the survival rate with Laetrile? And
well,
we're
I'm
talking about far
that.
Advanced. We're not talking about getting it early because I don't think they get very many patients early.
No, they don't, but they do get a few. I'm glad you asked that because everybody wants statistics. And unfortunately, statistics are not very reliable because there's so many variables. But in spite of that, people still want statistics. So I made a good stab at that, the best stab I could in my book, Stan.
I know you did. That's why I asked you the question.
and to come up with a real honest evaluation, not trying to weight it one way or the other. And here's what I came up with. And I did this back in 1974, and ever since then, all of the numbers I've seen have reinforced that was a correct evaluation. I didn't have to change it one percentage point. Basically, what we have is this, that most of the people that go on to Laetrile therapy have already been pronounced as terminal cancer patients. They've gone through radiation, chemotherapy, surgery, and they're terminal. Their doctors have told them, go home, put your lives in order, you only have a few weeks or a couple of months to live. They turn to Laetrile therapy as a last-ditch effort, and they go down to the clinics in Mexico or to Dr. Binzel out in Ohio, and they literally carried on stretchers. Now, that's the condition of most patients that go on this therapy. In that group, terminal cancer patients, 15% are going to survive. Now, that's not very good. That means, you know, 85% are going to go out the door.
No, but they were all going to die anyway.
But they were all going to die without that. So when you look at it that way, it's an amazing survival rate, that 15%. And the other 85%, for the most part, are painless, they get rid of their pain, and their lifestyle improves for the time that they do have remaining.
And do you think it prolongs life?
I don't know about that. I wouldn't be surprised if it does, but even if it doesn't, the quality of life has been greatly improved.
Okay, we're going to have to take our break. Hey, hang on there, Kevin. We'll be back to you.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, one thing I remember from my conversation with Dr. Dean Burke, and I suppose this was, I've forgotten whether it was the early 70s, probably was the early 70s, and the one thing I remember him telling me was, but even if it doesn't cure the people, they all feel better. They put on weight, their pain is gone, and that's just what Ed has been saying. The patient feels so much better. Because of the effect of the Laetrile, although his body may well be riddled with cancer, his immune system has been destroyed because of the treatment, the chemotherapy and radiation. He's lost his hair. But if you can relieve his pain, he will certainly be grateful to you.
Yes, and you know, there are some more statistics to that.
Okay,
Dan.
Go ahead.
I think, that need to be added to round out this picture. We've taken the worst-case scenario of people who are terminal. There are a lot of people turning to laetrile therapy who are not quite that far gone, especially as this word gets out and they hear about it, and they decide, well, wait a minute, I'm not going to go this other route of chemotherapy and radiation. I saw what it did to my mother, saw what it did to my sister, saw what it did to my aunt, and so forth. And they said, no, I'm not going to do that. So increasingly we're getting people who choose laetrile and nutritional therapy as their first option. Now, in that group, we have a whole different set of statistics. Instead of being 85% loss and 15% survival, it flips over the other way around. 85% in that group will survive. 85% in the group of early detection, if they get on a good nutritional program, including laetrile and all the other things we've talked about, 85% will survive and live a perfectly normal life.
Okay, well, those are certainly surprising statistics, and I think something to think about. Now, Dudley called back in, didn't want to come back on the air, but he wanted you to define what you meant by 15% survive, go to the Mexico clinics. And I think you're pretty obvious what you mean. You mean that 15% of the people who go there who are terminal will be improved. Now, are this 15%, do they go back to a fairly normal lifestyle as long as they, keep up with some sort of laetrile and change their nutrition?
Yes, exactly. When I say that they're survivors, I don't mean that they're just living with a tube in their nose or something like that. I'm talking about they return to work, they feel good, they feel as good as they ever did, they play golf, chop wood, swim, have babies, you know, they don't even know they have cancer. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, and now where did those figures come from?
Well, those come from the files of Dr. Contreras, Dr. Richardson, Dr. Krebs, Dr. Binzel, all of the doctors around the United States and the world, for that matter, that I have been in contact with. I have consulted with them and asked them to give me their numbers. And I've asked them to be very, very conservative, not blow it up. And I know these men. They're not trying to, they're not trying to blow smoke at anybody. They just wish the figures would be better, but they're very happy with what they are.
Now, what about...
And also, I might add, with my own personal experience, I've known a lot of people that have gone into this routine. I've watched them, and I've personally followed probably 100 or so. And from my own observation of the people I knew, those numbers are about correct.
Now, what about in Europe? I understand that at one time you could get the medication in Europe and in other countries. What does that stand today? Do you have any idea?
Well, I'm not too up on that, but I believe you could still get it in Germany. Now, the Germans have more trouble getting it than the Americans. It's one of those quirky things, you know. You can do things for foreigners that you can't do for your own citizens.
I see. But in other words, an American could go to Germany and get the laetrile, but
yes.
A German can't get it.
That's my understanding of it, yes.
Okay. Kevin, did you have any other questions?
Yes, I have one more question, and I'd like to just ask the question and then take the answer on the air. I've always thought that when Betty Ford went down to Mexico when she had her cancer, that must have been a real thorn in the anti-laetrile crowd. What's your thoughts on that? And again, thank you, Ed, for coming on, and I'll take my answer on the air.
Okay, thanks, Kevin. Okay, do you know anything about Betty Ford's going to Mexico? I didn't remember that.
No, I remember hearing about that, and I can't vouch that she did, but... I do agree with Kevin that even the rumor that she might have done so would have been a thorn in the side of the, orthodox medicine. I have to say that I don't know anything about that.
Okay, and I certainly don't know anything about it either. Maybe Kevin can get some documentation on that. But, as we tell this incredible, incredible story, I'm sure the people out there in the listening audience are saying, I just can't believe this, because... if this were true, certainly every American would know. And if there is a conscious effort to prevent people from, or to make it very difficult for people to get apricot pits, if they want to eat apricot pits, people ought to have a right to be able to go down and buy apricot pits at a health food store without having the proprietors of those stores harassed and handcuffed and threatened. And certainly if people want to take laetrile, doctors ought to be able to give it, even if they don't believe in it, And certainly they shouldn't have to go down to Mexico to get that or have to jump through all the hoops and all of the things. In fact, most doctors, I think today, would be afraid to give Laetrile. I had a personal friend of mine in, I was practicing in New Zealand, and this woman came to him. She had terminal cancer, and she had the Laetrile, just wanted him to give it, and he did, and she said she got dramatically better. And he came under all sorts of pressure from the people in the hospital for daring to give this this quack medicine, and yet help the patient.
Yes. Well, you have to realize what we said earlier in the program is that the doctors, the medical profession, most of the personnel in the profession are not part of this conscious conspiracy to destroy the health of the world. They are victims as much as anyone else. And they actually believe that Laetrile is quackery because all of their peers have told them so. All of the magazines they read have told them so. The schools they graduated from have told them so. And they have no reason so far to question the validity of these judgments of their peers and their superiors. So they just accept it. And they honestly, these FDA officials that come by and put the handcuffs on these people, they honestly believe that they're arresting some bad people who are preying upon the fears and the illnesses of these poor, uninformed cancer patients. They honestly believe that. And so our battle here really is for the minds of men. Truth has to be broken through here.
Well, now, I remember how they really demonized Dr. John Richardson. I knew John Richardson. I know you knew him as well. And I can remember when he was under attack by the local medical authorities, and they took pictures of his house. I remember seeing the pictures of his house in the San Francisco Chronicle, and the caption was, "Look at that terribly expensive house that this doctor has. We've got these aerial pictures of it, and anybody could afford that. A house like that, you know that he's making an awful lot of money off the suffering of his cancer patients."
That's dirty pool. He had that house long before he started to use Laetrile. He was a very successful physician. And some physicians make a lot of money, including those using chemotherapy and radiation.
Sure.
So that's dirty pool.
Oh, but that's the technique that the government and the establishment always uses. It doesn't matter whether a person's guilty or innocent. If you can demonize them and make them look bad enough, it's like white supremacist Randy Weaver. When did you ever hear the term Randy Weaver without hearing the white supremacist?
Yeah, they have to tell you what to think about him first.
Right, and of course that way you demonize him, and you know it was his fault that they killed his wife and his son.
Yeah, right.
Because he was a white supremacist. And I don't know whether he's a white supremacist or not, but I don't believe...
But even if he were, that's no excuse to kill his
wife. You don't kill your wife and son, and you don't come up there with a group of government agents with semi-automatic or automatic weapons, start shooting at a 14-year-old boy. And you don't go around killing dogs, and they did everything they could to precipitate the whole incident by entrapping Randy Weaver, and they actually entrapped him with a government agent. They spent 3 years paying a government agent to entrap him, to befriend him, to pretend to be, believing in what he believed in and visit him, just to get him to saw off one or two shotguns half an inch or so shorter than a federal law so that then they could force him to do their will. And when
a good analogy, Stan, because, you see, the agent that entrapped him probably thought he was doing his patriotic duty.
Right.
He really thought that this guy was evil and needed to be arrested, and so he was merely hastening the day when that would happen. The FDA agents have done the same thing with cancer patients. They'll follow cancer patients who are taking Laetrile therapy, and they'll interview them, and they keep looking for one that's dissatisfied so that they can use that one person who's dissatisfied to bring a lawsuit against the doctor that's treating them. So it's entrapment, and those FDA agents honestly believe that they're doing the right thing by creating a case, no matter how much they have to work to do it, by creating a case against this evil doctor who is using this unproven cancer therapy.
Well, now, did Dr. Richardson continue using the Laetrile up till the time he got terminally ill?
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he fought the bureaucracy, of course. You know, they took his license. He had to close his practice down. He went to Nevada and opened up again. He got another license, I believe, as a, I've forgotten what it was. It was a naturopathic doctor.
Mm-hmm,
he actually went to school and got another license, and he practiced under that. and they harassed him there in Nevada, and then he went and treated patients in a clinic in Mexico. So he was one of those guys that just wouldn't say stop.
And of course, what they do is they just put on pressure,
yeah,
and use every agency of government to stop people,
yeah,
from really doing what they think is helpful, and that is saving human lives. And
right,
it's really one of the great tragedies of our time. Now, a lot of your book, at least the second half of the book, gets into really the international cartels and the drug cartels. Would you like to just comment on that and how it ties into total corruption in our government, how it ties in, and you demonstrate how these people actually control the presidency and the attorney general's office and the massive payoffs to government agents from the international cartels, payoffs to people in the FDA, and et cetera?
I'm supposed to do all that in 15 minutes?
No, actually, if you could do it in five, no, go ahead. Let's just get started. What's the appetite of our listeners out there? So they'll want to get your book, because this is a lot more than a book about Laetrile. This is a book about the power structure working behind the scenes that really is America's and the world's invisible government.
Well, yes. It's one of the realities that I came to very quickly in my own research on the topic was that the science of cancer therapy wasn't nearly as complicated as the politics of cancer therapy. And when I say politics, I include economics in that. And that's where the real action is, and where the imponderables are.
Now, let me just comment that some of your remarks about the American Medical Association, how really the president of the American Medical Association, the physicians who's elected to the presidency of the AMA, is simply a figurehead. There's a bureaucracy there that controls it. The executive board controls it, and they have their own agenda, totally independent of the agenda of the average physician across America who's practicing and trying to help people and save lives.
Yes, well, you're an expert on that because you've been there firsthand.
Oh, yeah.
And I've just read about it, but that's certainly my impression. The average doctor who's a member of the AMA joins it because it's good for his business, good for his practice, and he figures that he might learn something, too, and have a voice in the organization's affairs. But if he tries to exert himself in any way contrary to the direction of the board and the staff, he soon finds himself encapsulated and rendered completely useless.
And this has happened here, and the California Medical Association happened to me year after year. The doctors would vote that they wanted an effective approach to the epidemic of one sort or another. And year after year, the leaders of organized medicine refused to carry out this and support the simple public health approaches that would have saved the lives of millions of people across America. And, of course, the same thing has happened at the American Medical Association level. Year after year, the doctors voted in favor of mandatory prenatal testing for HIV disease to save the lives of unborn children. And year after year, the AMA would always appoint a committee to study it and say, well, the doctors didn't understand the implications of a mandatory prenatal testing. Why? They would find out that women were infected. They'd tell the women, maybe the women didn't want to know. Don't people have a right to not to know that they're infected? And all this, you know, the incredible things that they were coming up with, anything to avoid doing what was medically proper to save human lives. And if they would do that for HIV, they'd certainly do it for cancer.
Right. Well, anyway, in a nutshell, what really happened here is that at the turn of the century, the medical profession in America was in kind of a state of disarray. There were some very good doctors and some very bad doctors, and there were too many doctors who'd gotten their diplomas through the mail, and they had no real medical training, and so this was a condition which probably in time would have resolved itself through the forces of supply and demand and competition, free enterprise competition. But in any event, at that particular point in history, it needed a lot of improvement. And so the Rockefeller Foundation and some of the groupings that were very heavily involved in the pharmaceutical industry decided to take control of the medical profession, and they did it with money. They created what's called the Flexner Commission. They hired a fellow by the name of Abraham Flexner to survey the condition of medical schools in America. He came back with a report, which they paid for. The report said that the schools were in dire need of reform and upgrading and improvement. And so the report was widely applauded. And then the boys with the investments in the pharmaceutical industry began to donate money to certain of the schools to improve and upgrade their medical education. They transfused millions and millions of dollars into certain of the schools, and others they ignored.
In other words, whoever pays the piper calls the tune. Right.
When the money came, of course, the schools were so grateful to receive it because now they could build new buildings, they could hire qualified people, they could get new laboratory instruments, they could improve their curricula. But along with the money came the control, because the donor would say, well, now that we've given you this $5 million, certainly you wouldn't mind if we had one or two of our people on your board of directors at the university, would you, to see that our money is spent wisely?
No. Go right ahead. Who do you want?
Yeah, who do you want? And, of course, the people they would recommend would be upstanding citizens with good reputation, so they'd be delighted to have them. And in this process, and I'm putting it very succinctly here and very short, but over a period of about 10 years, it didn't take very long, these financial interests were able to literally take control of the medical profession in America by the schools. They became the dominant force in the schools that determined the curricula and selected the kind of teachers they wanted. They wanted research teachers. They moved the whole field away from patient treatment in general toward pharmaceuticals. So eventually what happened is that this money that they donated to the schools came back to them because they were now turning out highly paid drug salesmen. These doctors were getting a very good education, much better than they did before, but it was all skewed in the direction of drugs and pharmaceuticals. So if they knew nothing else, they knew how to prescribe drugs. So from that point forward in history, the medical profession became a kind of a front for the pharmaceutical industry. And the average doctor, as you know, Stan, wouldn't believe it if you told him. They have no inkling that their training has been skewed in this fashion.
And, of course, the knowledge of herbs and homeopathy, many of the old techniques have just sort of gone by the wayside. It's interesting that herbs are beginning to come back, and St. John's wort is beginning to be more effective than Prozac, and that's going to cost hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to the
industry. Yes, well, they're fighting it. You see, they're already, every time one of these herbs is found to be effective, it doesn't take long before you read in the newspaper that the FDA is concerned over misuse of this.
Yeah, in fact, L-tryptophan, which was an excellent product to take to put people to sleep instead of sleeping pills, and because one company in Japan put out a bad lot and half a dozen people died of that with an eosinophilic myalgia, suddenly they've outlawed it in America.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, you know, there was one bad lot, and yet they have used that as a justification because L-tryptophan was cutting into the sleeping pill market. And as incredible as it may seem, that's just what's happened with the cancer industry.
That's exactly the pattern, and you'll see it happen over and over and over again. Every time a new herb is found to be effective and starts to be widely used, the FDA will come on the scene and say, well, we're very concerned. This has caused two people to get sick. One person died, we understand. So now we have to control it, and you can only get it through a prescription or whatever.
Right.
So it's back to the pharmaceutical houses.
Okay, now how does this all tie into IG Farben? Because IG Farben, and then, of course, the interlock with the most powerful family probably in the world, as far as I can see, the Rockefeller family. How does this all work together?
Well, IG Farben is, for the benefit of your listeners that may not be familiar with that phrase, is the name of a cartel that originated in Germany prior to World War I. It stands for Interessengemeinschaft, and that means a community of interest. I think that's how it's generally translated. And in American terminology, that would be a cartel.
Aren't cartels illegal?
No, they're not illegal. They certainly weren't illegal in that period of history. I mean, I would say 80% of American industry is cartelized today.
Yeah, but, of course, that's why we have these antitrust laws. That's to ensure the cartels will survive and destroy competition.
That's right. The antitrust laws are written by the cartels, or the monopolists, to keep competition away.
And anybody who doesn't understand that... well, it's incredibly
they're
naive.
They're still in kindergarten.
Right.
They don't understand the real world in which we live. But anyway, historically, IG Farben started in Germany as a chemical industry producing dyestuffs. That was the beginning of the modern chemical industry. And it didn't take long before that expanded into pharmaceuticals and munitions. Well, now you don't make much money on dying stuffs, but you sure make a lot of money with munitions and pharmaceuticals, because now you've got your finger on the pulse of the greatest motivation to man, and that is to avoid illness or to kill, you know, to survive. So if you happen to be an industry that can both kill and cure, you've got an unlimited source of funding coming your way if you just can manipulate it correctly. So here we had IG Farben, which became a cartel that was not just in Germany, but covered all of Europe and finally spilled over to the United States as well. And in my book, I have a listing of all of the American companies, that well-known companies, everything from Chef Boyardee to Firestone Rubber. I mean, all of these great American companies had cartel contracts and links with IG Farben. Now, that didn't mean that they were completely owned or dominated by IG Farben, but they had very important cartel links with them. By that I mean they had agreements, non-competitive agreements, where they agreed to share patents and production facilities, or they shared something and agreed to fix prices and divide up markets and not to compete in one way or another. And this particularly became true in the pharmaceutical field. And the Rockefeller grouping in America became the dominant partners of IG Farben. And the two areas in which they had the most overlapping were, of course, oil, petroleum, and the pharmaceutical industry. Prior to World War II, IG Farben was the dominant component in pharmaceuticals, and Rockefeller was the dominant component in petroleum. Since World War II, and the IG Farben cartel was pretty well broken up, although it still survives, it doesn't have the power it used to have. Now it's clear that the Rockefeller grouping has taken over the reins of power and continues on with the same kind of industrial power over the major corporations of the world because of cartel interlinks. Now that's just to say that it sounds kind of bizarre, but that's the reason I wrote a half a book on that very topic. It's the kind of thing that you don't learn in school. And one of the things that most amazed me, for example, I'm just sort of splashing around on the topic here, Stan, is that when I studied the rise of the Nazi regime, for example, in school, I got the general impression from my textbooks that the German industry was taken over by the Nazi government, and that it was directed by the Nazi government, and that was the nature of fascism, which was control by the state over industry. And that's the textbook definition. I think most of the books still say that. But when I got actually into the history of this, I realized that it was the other way around. IG Farben financed the rise of Hitler. Hitler had no money until IG Farben started to give it to him. And the newspapers owned by IG Farben started to treat him favorably, as on a command. All of a sudden, he was the favored candidate among all of the other contenders for revolutionary groups arising in Germany. And they literally populated his whole government with their own people. They controlled Hitler. Hitler did not control them. And it was a facade to make it look the other way around.
Ed, we're out of time. I hope I've whetted the appetite of our listeners. You will find some of the most amazing facts of who really controls the industrial and corporate power in America, in the world without cancer. You can get the book by calling 1-800-282-2873. That's 1-800-282-2873. Ed, thanks so very much for being with us, and I look forward to having you on again in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you very much, Stan. Good night.
Bye-bye, and God bless you. Okay, fine. Well, that was Ed Griffin, one of the most astute observers that we have, and I hated to cut him off because we could have gone on for another hour just on this subject, and maybe we can get into it some other evening. But I hope we've intrigued you. I hope we've given you some glimpse of the fact that there really are treatments out there. Now, Ed thinks this is all having to do with money and power. I think it has to do with genocide. And I think that the desire for money and power and genocide go right together. And I believe that the forces that are pushing worldwide genocide many times work through our great corporate structures and work through our great American foundations, Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford, because behind everything there are spiritual forces. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision.